session number 28354, reel 15.
We were talking about where one learned anti-submarine.
Before into a commando ship, whatever it was, a submarine frigate carrier, you had to do a tactical course at HMS Dryad. And I'd done one before I'd gone into Hermes, and did one before I went as captain of Cheviot, etc. And in that, you, in the tactical school, very realistically, it was played in real time and realistically done. And nowadays, very, very realistically done. I've been to see some of the modern ones. And you learnt it there, and you learnt it actually practically on the job rather more. I'm sure the Americans had a tactical school. Whether I was always very critical of American tactics generally, not just carrier captains' tactics. I don't think the captains of the destroyers either were tactically as skillful as ours are or were, and certainly needs to be.
What devices and defences did you have to detect submarines? What did you use?
The ASNIC. We had the Wessex helicopters with the Dunking sonar. So it's all a matter of tactics and placing your helicopters in the right place and adjusting your screen around you in the right manner so that you detected the submarines and were able to deal with them before they dealt with you. One never would have succeeded all the time, but I think we'd have succeeded better than most. Where am I? I've now worked up and finished and done that exercise.
And you've gone to Lisbon at the end of it.
Yeah. Oh, yes, and that was when I said that the Americans didn't like being sunk and couldn't be. There was from there, where did we go there? Went back in the Mediterranean and back to Malta, I think. And we had a visit at the end of the workup at some stage to Beirut. I don't think there's anything really to tell you there about that, except for the scene on the flight deck during the cocktail party. We had the usual reception, and all the guests came up the flight deck, and the Admiral and I stood at the top and greeted them as the lift came up and they stepped off it. And they were an awful boring looking lot, actually, these guests. And it was quite evident that the wardroom thought that they weren't doing their stuff at all. And I got very angry seeing a lot of our guests standing around not being hosted properly by my officers. So I quit my Admiral in the reception line and went back and blasted them and told them to do better and to go and talk to them and be courteous to their guests, and went back and stood by the Admiral, at which minute the lift came up with 12 Bluebell girls from the Lido nightclub. And the whole wardroom and every officer swarmed. There was no problem. These girls got thoroughly well entertained and looked after. But it was... It was a good joke. Everybody found this extremely funny. The captain should get angry with his officers, and then this lot come up and redeem them, so to speak. They were very pretty, I must say. They were all English except the last one. There were 12 of them, and 11 of them were English girls. And the last, and as she came along the line, she did say to me, "Et moi, je suis française." one French girl. What's the author? The author that lived in...
In where?
Oh, no, this is later, in Malaga. No, sorry. This is later, another story. No, I don't think you've got any more there about Beirut. It was a... I, a lovely visit. Those are the days of the quietness of Beirut.
Yes.
I'd always admired Beirut so much that they managed to manage their communal difficulties so well, and then it all blew up. Yeah. Now, after this, our deployment in the Mediterranean came to an end, and we came back to the UK. Well, this is now that was the whole of 1962, really. I was in the Mediterranean and came back to the UK in the autumn there. From where we sailed, I'm trying to think just when. That must be, I suppose it's maybe November, December of 62, we sailed for the Far East. Obviously, again, via the Mediterranean. And through the Suez Canal. I've never been through Suez Canal in a carrier before. That's fun again. Half the canal not visible under your rundown.
But you have a pilot, of course.
I have a pilot, yes.
Yes.
Very good pilot. An Egyptian pilot. Extremely good. Nothing really to talk about there. We went into Aden, following HMS Albion, who was a helicopter carrier, who had preceded us by a short time. We stayed in Aden and Field. There's a good story about that Albion, when she was in, came into Aden at that time, girded the tug. Girding a tug was when a tug gets broadside onto you, and then the ship then moves away from the tug and pulls it over sideways and tips it over and it capsizes. And Albion girded her tug and it tipped over and went to the bottom.
How exactly do you achieve that then? How exactly does it happen?
It's a bad handling by the tug, getting in the wrong position, probably. It could be the ship's fault. If it moved ahead at the time a tug was going round. When a tug has to change position, it goes round at 90 degrees to its toe, obviously, in a circuit. If the ship moves then, you gird the tug. Whether that happened, I don't know. And the tug's name was Higginbottom. It was named after a previous, all the tugs apparently were named after previous governors of Aden. The governor of Aden at that time was forgotten. I think it was Creasy again, but it doesn't matter. And anyway, he came down to breakfast the next morning after this episode and saw all his Somali boys in his dining room round his table smiling enormous white smiles across their back faces, and he said to number one boy, "Why are you all smiling?" And he said, "Bottom sob on bottom sob." They hadn't liked Mr. Higgin so something Higginbottom the previous, so bottom sob on bottom sob, said the number one boy. Now we went I don't think there's any episodes of interest that I can think of on our passage to Singapore. We obviously flew off Gan and then went on, and I think we flew off Penang using Butterworth as a one. You had to fly anyway, you would get an airfield as a diversion. I mean, you steam many miles at 24 knots and then slowed down and flew your airplanes while you had an airfield and then stamped on at 24 knots until all your pilots were dead, both day and night qualified to fly without a diversion. One was very rarely fully in this state, I found. There was always somebody you had to hurry for. And indeed on... I've forgotten, actually. You're going back into the Mediterranean. The last thing we did in the Mediterranean was an exercise in the Aegean. That's right. A NATO exercise. Or, no, it's... Oh, very unusual one. A CENTO exercise. There was that organisation then, there. This was in the most tremendous gale. I've never seen it so rough in the Aegean previously. Indeed, several of my aircraft got stuck ashore. And I'm telling, going back to this episode of this exercise in the Aegean, because it snowed, it was a blizzard, and I stopped flying because half my airplanes, I say, got stuck ashore because they couldn't get back to the ship. It was too rough and too thick, the blizzard. And for some reason, an aircraft handler on the flight deck was sent right forward on the flight deck to walk up into the bows of the ship to do something, to see if something had broken away or whatever. And he was bent double in all his heavy flight deck gear, and his helmet, his goggles, and his microphone and everything. He was bent double fighting against this gale along the flight deck and the blizzard going by him. And I said over the loop to the lieutenant commander flying in the flying control, that man looks just like Captain Oates leaving Captain Scott's tent. And the chap heard me, and he came back on the loop, and he said, "I feel more like Scott's porridge oats being blown out of the packet." Of a sort of quick repartee of a silly statement. It was wonderful. I feel more like Scott's porridge oats. All the right names, Scott's and oats and everything, blowing out of the packet. But we eventually got our aircraft back on board. But there was a photograph taken of a Gannet aircraft, aircraft early warning, early warning aircraft, of a Gannet aircraft on the flight, on the catapult, ready to take off, with a wave breaking right over the flight deck and over the aircraft. It was a wonderful photo, and I kept it actually. And one day when I was worrying that these aircraft were rotting in the salt, I haven't told this story before, have I? I was rotting with all the salt water getting into it. Much of the engine was made of manganese, and the manganese didn't like salt. Salt ate into it. Indeed, you could put your ear down and hear it sort of gargling and bubbling away as the manganese disintegrated. And I had on board somebody from Fairey Aviation, as it then was, doing some visit or other. And I said, I was complaining to him about the stuff, airplanes rotting like this. And I said, these airplanes have to stand up to seawater. Let me show you this photo. And he said, "But Captain, you asked me to make an aeroplane, not a submarine." Nothing much you could do, poor man. But but it was on that trip that happened. What was reminding me of that was that I had one pilot, not qualified. His name was Dunsterville, Lieutenant Dunsterville. And so I took that ship then at 24 knots from the Aegean to Gibraltar, colossal expenditure of fuel, in order to qualify one pilot finally in night flying. He became a very expensive night qualified pilot, did Dunsterville. I think he's still flying for Cathay Pacific.
You're in the Far East with... You're back to the Far East.
Yes. Okay. And I've got to Singapore.
Yes.
Now, where do we go there? Well... We got to Singapore, and I sent my wife a telegram, or whatever you sent in those days, to say that I'd done some sums. I was as poor as I thought we were. Why didn't she get in an airplane and come out to Hong Kong? Because I was going up there. And that was very successful. She got into an airplane, got in Hong Kong. And that telegram arrived, actually, or message arrived, just over Christmas of 1962, which, if you remember, was arctically cold. And she was under about a couple of foot of snow at the time and was absolutely delighted to buy a ticket and come out to Hong Kong. So it was a very get a good move.
Did you keep your ship's company throughout this time, or do people change or rotate, or only when at each commission?
No, there was a rotation, but it was a major change at each commission. Yes, yeah. You didn't change very much. It was trickle. Yeah, there were changes. Yes, I think you were on to. I don't remember whether we were on to continuous commission by then. I don't know. It was by chance, I think, the carrier changed. The carrier came in and did a big refit, or it paid off, or was turned into some other kind of carrier, rather than doing a commission. Now, on the way out, we did some flying. This is a mistake. On the way out, we did some flying in the off Aden, and just before we got to Aden initially, I did send the COD being the communications aircraft, which was a different kind of Gannet, which was used to go and get the mail, and I did tell the Commander Air to send this thing off, and he launched it, but its wheels wouldn't go up, so it flew around the ship for a bit, and then since it couldn't retract its wheels, the Commander Air said it was to land back on board and not go into Aden to get the mail. The Lieutenant Commander flying said it shouldn't land back on board because it was overweight for landing. And the Commander Air said it is to land on board, bugger the overweight. And the Commander Air said, but it's overweight, it can't land, the Lieutenant Commander. And a full-scale argument was going on the flight, and the Lieutenant Commander flying actually, I've only the only episode in my life I know of this, he did actually fling the book at the Commander Air. And the Commander there then flung him off the flying patrol and landed the aircraft on perfectly safely. I then had the dilemma. I had to court-martial the 10th Commander flying, and didn't particularly want to, actually, because part of it was the Commander Air was such an extremely difficult man. But then when we got into Aden, I met the flag officer, Middle East, and I met his secretary, a chap called John Walters, who was a professional lawyer, qualified QC or whatever. And so when we got to Singapore, in fact, that's the first thing I had to court-martial my Lieutenant Commander flying. This I did, and I prosecuted him myself and convicted him, and he was reprimanded. But of course, he had to be relieved. They couldn't go on together, these two. So he flew home, poor chap. He was a nice man, but he was a weak man. That was all quite happy for me, and another officer who could do the job, who we pushed up and pushed into his place until I got a proper replacement. But the denouement of this is that the whole thing was quashed by the judge advocate of the Navy. I've forgotten his name now, but he was the man that was involved in the man that never was. You remember the body that was dropped in the sea for the landings on North Africa. It was quashed, and I was so angry about this, on the technicality that this chap was charged with absence, sorry, quitting his place of duty. Because after he threw the book, he quit the flying control and went into the cabin. And the judge advocate of the Navy argued that the cabin was still on the flying control, so he had not left his place of duty. Now, how you can be in your place of duty sitting on a bunk with a door closed is beyond me, but it was quash, and I must say I thought that was law niggling in the most absurd fashion ever, and regretted the Navy could possibly do it. So that was my first task in Singapore. Admiral Dreyer was commanding the Far East Fleet then, Vice Admiral Sir Desmond Dreyer, whom I'd known very well in the past and liked very much indeed. The only reason I mention is I went up to Admiralty House and did something I'd always wanted to do there. While nobody was looking, I pushed back the carpet in the big sitting room and saw what I thought, which is that there was a beautiful, the whole of Admiralty House was carpeted. This seemed to me ludicrous in a tropical climate. It wasn't my business, but it still seemed to me ludicrous. And underneath a beautiful teak parquet everywhere. And this is all right, I was able to put this right years and years later. But that was when I pushed the thing back to see what the floor was like. So we went, we did some qualifying of flyers off Singapore. And this is where we had another accident, actually. A young man had come out from England, and we landed an aircraft for him to fly on board in order to do what you call it, I can't remember what they're called now. You know, you just touch down and take off circuits and bumps, that's right, I get the right word, to do circuits and bumps before arresting him for the first time. And he did circuits and bumps, satisfactory number, and he was happy, and we were happy that we could land him on. And so the next time round we told him to land on, and he came to land on, and he did not catch a wire. He came over a little bit too high, and then did not open the throttle to fly round. Just went off the angle, having missed all the wires. His nose cocked up in the air, and as the aircraft stalled, with the lieutenant commander flying, yelling at him to, first of all, yelling at him to open the throttle, and secondly, to bail out, bail out, bail out. But he went in, and both he and the observer were lost. An extraordinary accident, and to see this aeroplane just go drifting up, and nose up, and in his gear, when we came to pack all his gear up, there was a sort of cartoon, which we presume he'd drawn, of a sea vixen crashing into the sea. Very odd one. It's almost as odd as this chap who cut his parachute things and, yes, and did a free dive. Yes. This is very odd and eerie to find that picture. There we are. So I never got to know that young man. So we went. I think I better stop now, if you don't mind.
No, you're fine. Well, we're almost at the end of this tape.
You are.
We're coming to the end of your time in Singapore on Hermes. Or not?
Well, no, really, the beginning. Start,
no,
yes.
No, just yes, the beginning. All right. Well, we'll stop there.
You can ask me any questions, actually.
No, fine. Thank you. But I'm just ascertaining to help you when we restart. But we'll restart then another day with your time in the Far East then in Hermes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's best.
Yeah, I can go on. If you've got a bit, I can go on
yes,
a bit.
Yes, yes, of course.
Because here we've changed admirals, which I hadn't forgotten to say. Frank Hopkins, whom I was so fond of, was replaced by God almighty. The new flag officer aircraft carriers was Rear Admiral Donald Gibson. Obviously another aviator, and a man I became very, very fond of indeed. and thought extremely highly of also. Again, Donald wasn't thought so highly of by a lot of his peers and his seniors, and the reason was that he was so bad at expressing himself on paper. And he expressed himself very forcefully and somewhat, sometimes tactlessly and sometimes erroneously. And his secretary used to come to me when I was his flag captain saying, "Look, sir, the Admiral's written this letter and I don't like it." I said, I think it's awful. And I'd go to Donald and say, "Look, please, sir, don't say it." And he would never change it. So that's what I want to say. And he said it. But the secretary and I could see what harm these rather unnecessary things he was doing were doing to him. He was an accident-prone aviator. He's had various... he was a wonderful storyteller. I can't remember now many of his stories. I just got very fond of Donald. Also out there, and obviously he flew his flag in my ship more than Donald did, because Donald wasn't out in the Far East all the time. He was back home, like Frank Hopkins had been. Was Jack Scatchard, Vice Admiral, or was he Rear Admiral, Jack Scatchard then. He was a salt horse, and he was Flag Officer Second in Command, Far East Fleet. And I took him around a lot. He was not a good admiral. He knew absolutely nothing about aircraft carriers to start with. That's not his fault, but he hadn't learned anything about aircraft carriers, that was. And I didn't really enjoy Jack Scatchard as an admiral. I quite liked him as a man, but except that he drank too much. He wasn't a very competent admiral. And I, in truth, this sounds boasting, but I used to run the exercises when Jack Scatchard was the flag officer in command. I really did. It wasn't he that that was running them. And of course, he realized this in his heart, and that he was inadequate, and was therefore unsure of himself. And the last thing I ever liked him to do was to have a press conference. But he did have to have them sometimes. But my heart used to sink during those press conferences, because he did display an awful lot of ignorance, I'm afraid. There we are. Jack shouldn't have been a rear admiral. He shouldn't. He shouldn't have been promoted.
So that's someone who slipped through the net somehow.
I've known Jack in 1944 when he was captain of HMS Fernie, I think it was, when I was captain of Cottesmore. The only remarkable thing I remember about the ship, I knew nothing about what that ship did, but was you would hear his voice all over the harbour. When that ship was securing to a buoy, he blasphemed and cursed at his forecastle and his forecastle officer and things. Jack was quite a nice man, but he wasn't very good admiral, I think. So I had both those at various times while we were in the Far East.
This might be an appropriate moment to stop at this moment. So we can continue next time then with... thank you for those two anecdotes about your immediate superiors. We'll continue next time then with your continuing story of Hermes in the Far East.
By then I've looked at this book and got some dates in mind, some sequence in my mind.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm sorry, sir.
No, it's fine.